Oh, no, I'm fine.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us today at AU Central and for those who've joined on Illuminate Live. Today's Lunch and Learn presentation is being recorded by Illuminate. The presentation will be posted onto the Research Center website and AU Space for anyone who wishes to view it at a later date. Now it's my pleasure to hand the microphone over to Derek Britton, who will continue with today's presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, the presentation today is on is based on a chapter that will be published in a book on Canadian popular culture by AU Press, and the chapter is based on the phenomenon of virtual worlds. And the idea was to look at, not to try to sort of list virtual worlds or to define them, but to look at their presence, their development, and the kind of impact they're having on Canadian popular culture. And also to, I'll finish up by talking a little bit about their educational implications in terms of what virtual worlds could be used for educationally and how we might get more pedagogical benefit out of them. So I want to begin initially with a timeline that just talks about the development of virtual worlds and puts them into perspective with some other networking, the development of networks, beginning with the first one, ARPANET, and then moves through and also situates them in relation to the development of web browsers, the first text browser links, and then with Mosaic, the first graphics-based browser, and moves on from there. So with that, I'll run the timeline, and it's pretty much self-explanatory. It's a short, quick-time movie, and it'll run through, and it'll give us a sense of what the development is like. So again, beginning with ARPANET, and then moving on to one of the first network games, Maze Wars. Later role-playing games that were networked, MUDs, and other joint network games, followed by the development of Usenet, and then another popular game, Islands of Kesmai. Moving on to Ultima 2, which was one of the defining games where the goal of the user was to become the avatar, something that became standard in many games after that. In 91, it was the first development of the massively multiple online role-playing games, things we'll be talking about later in the presentation. Also, first-person shooter games, Doom was one of the first of those in 91. So with 92, we had the development of the Mosaic browser. 94, the development of the Netscape Navigator, and as the browser capabilities became more sophisticated, so did the abilities to play these role-playing games online. '97 saw the advent of some of the first modern blogs, Ultima Online, then Half-Life, which was a very popular game, 8 million units sold in very quick succession. Habbo Hotel was one of the first of the games for teenagers rather than adults. Moving on to other first-person shooter games like Halo, Final Fantasy, role-playing. Gator Online, again, more of a teenage site rather than adult. Sims Online, one of the first social networking sites. Second Life, of course, is a virtual world, non-competitive, but that came online in 2003. And in 2004, we had the advent of World of Warcraft, which is a very popular role-playing game. Again, further development in web browsers. 2004 saw the advent of Firefox. In 2005, Guild Wars, that's an open-source networking game, which was very popular. And in 2006, you see how the numbers sort of increased rapidly. There's a proliferation in 2007. And in 2008, several games, and currently Wikipedia actually lists 177 massively multiple online role-playing games currently in existence. So it's a huge phenomenon and involves millions of people. Okay, so moving into the presentation section. Virtual worlds are a very recent phenomenon on the cultural stage. And although massively multiple online games, that's MMOGs as often referred to, and massively multiple online role-playing games, MMORPGs, comprise the first instances of virtual worlds, many non-competitive virtual environments now exist. That's environments such as Second Life. Virtual worlds are an ongoing topic of interest and discussion on the internet, and although the acronyms hardly roll off the tongue, this has not stifled their use. A Google search for the acronym MMOG yields 5.25 million results, and a search for the acronym MMORPG, 35.5 million. Since their inception in 2004, the universe of virtual worlds has expanded dramatically. And as I said earlier, Wikipedia currently lists 177 games. The screen right now starts off with Maze Wars, which was also known as the Maze Game. That was the first network 3D multi-user game. And it was Maze that brought the concept of online players as sort of eyeballs or avatars chasing something around on screen. It's just a sample of the games that are available currently. So what I focused on when I was developing the chapter for the book were sort of exemplars of virtual worlds. And these were Second Life, which is the non-competitive virtual world, Halo, which is a first-person shooter game, and World of Warcraft, which is a role-playing fantasy game. So there is some contention about how virtual worlds calculate the number of players or inhabitants. Second Life, for instance, counts every subscription created since its inception in 2003. World of Warcraft, on the other hand, counts only current active paying users. But such disputes aside, the numbers remain staggering. As of April 2008, World of Warcraft declared over 10 million users who were paying at least $12 a month to play the game. And Second Life declared over 12.3 million. That includes free and premium subscriptions. And on its US release date, which was September 25th, 2007, Halo 3 sold close to 2.4 million copies in the first 24 hours for a total of $174 million. And after the first week, total worldwide sales reached over 300 million. Halo 3 is an Xbox 360 exclusive, and Halo 3 certainly contributed significantly to the sales of those gaming units, doubling previous sales for a total of 17.7 million units as of January 2008. And we're talking about a piece of equipment that cost about $300 there. That's just the hardware. As of the same date, Microsoft calculated Halo 3 users numbered in excess of 8.1 million. Just a little trivia here. On October 11th, 2008, I checked the Bungie.com homepage. Bungie is the creator of Halo, and it displayed 157,327 Halo players online. Of those, 864,906 were unique players in the last 24 hours, so they were new sign-ons. And the site was listing a total campaign killer count of 8,082,798,000, which is almost a billion and a half greater than the world's estimated population. And as of December 8, 2008, the kill count was 8.5 billion. So it gives you some sense of the amount of time and hours that the people putting in on these games, and hopefully gives you puts it somewhat in perspective. But this does not mean that the ruling triumvirate, that is Second Life, World of Warcraft, and Halo, can afford to sit in their laurels. As of September 2008, Sulaki's Habbo, a socializing community building virtual hotel for teens, surpassed Second Life in terms of total subscribers, over 100 million, and longtime industry leader World of Warcraft in terms of active users. Habbo Hotel initially, it was Habbo Hotel, now it's simply called Habbo, has the largest player base of any online game or virtual world, 7.5 million players per month. which significantly surpasses World of Warcraft, which is around about 4.5 million right now, which is still a lot of people. The idea of Habbo Hotel is that people actually occupy or rent hotel rooms and furnish them. They can purchase furniture and decor, and there's various forms of interaction too. You can see on the larger picture on the screen there that there's that's the celebration for their 100 millionth subscriber. And the other two pictures are just giving you an idea of what the Habbo hotel rooms look like. One's actually sort of a bedroom, and the other is an office that someone has built. And as of June 2008, a report by Strategy Analytics, which is a research company in the States, reveals that these figures may be just scratching the surface, declaring that over the next 10 years, some 22% of global broadband users will have registered for one or more virtual worlds, resulting in a market approaching 1 billion registrants and $8 billion services opportunity. This is a huge emerging market, and it still isn't anywhere near its peak. Now, the appeal of virtual worlds is broad, but gamers are often stereotyped. You know, you need to be Asian to be a good video gamer. All gamers are morbidly obese people who can't stand daylight. Girls can't play video games. If you play World of Warcraft, you'll never get a date. All gamers are way too hardcore. These are sort of fairly typical stereotypes that have been around the net for a long time. But these stereotypes have been challenged in the past with anecdotal evidence, but a recent control study, more scientific study, of a popular massively multiple online role-playing game, that was Sony Corporation's EverQuest 2, reveals just how unfounded most are. The study, published September 2008 in the Journal of Computer Media and Communication, reveals a number of facts about gamers. The average age is about 32 years, and there are actually more players in their 30s and 20s. That goes against sort of the common conception of gamers, who are meant to be sort of young males. Older players surprisingly play more hours per week than younger, and the older they get, the more hours they play. The male to female gender distribution is 80% male, 19.2% female, but they found that females actually play more per week than the males, so more hours online. Players' incomes, on average, are $25,000 per annum above the American average, and their education levels are also above average. Whites and Native Americans play above average rates, but Asians, Blacks, and Hispanics and Latinos play below. So this goes counter to the sort of the common stereotype that Asians spend all their time playing video games. In fact, it's whites and Native Americans who play more. And also surprisingly, gamers are generally healthier than the average population, with lower body mass indexes. And older gamers are especially fit in comparison to their non-gamer counterparts. Such evidence that gamers are in better physical health than the general population, and that older gamers play more than younger, that female gamers play more than male, and that Caucasians play more than Asians, and that players are motivated for social reasons, this is another finding of the study, certainly dispel long-held stereotypes of gamers. The popularity of virtual worlds has not escaped the attention of the old media, and several U.S. television networks have featured massively multiple online role-playing games in primetime TV shows in an attempt to cash in on their growing popularity. The Comedy Network took a satirical poke at massively multiple games in South Park October 4, 2006. NBC, in an episode of The Office, featured the first-person shooter game Call of Duty in one of their shows. NBC followed this with Law & Order Special Victims Unit, an episode named Avatar, where they looked at a virtual world, which was, the name of it was Virtual U, but it was very similar to Second Life in terms of how it looked. CBS followed that with two episodes of CSI New York, Down the Rabbit Hole on October 25, 2007, and DOA for a Day on April 2, 2008. What was interesting about this particular development was that CBC used Cisco Systems telepresence technology during both shows, and also had recently had the corporation that acquired Electric Sheep, which is a development company within Second Life, and they used Electric Sheep to actually develop a version of Second Life that the audience was invited to enter into and to investigate a specially staged crime that they could explore in a virtual stage. So it was a significant development in terms of bringing the old and new media together. NBC also featured Second Life on October 25th in another episode of The Office entitled Local Ad, and this made specific reference to Second Life, the idea of actually advertising for employees in a virtual world. And finally, CBS on November 9th of 2007 in their series Numbers featured another massively multiple online role-playing game, this time one that wasn't named but was very like Second Life in one of their episodes. Now, not surprisingly, the virtual world phenomenon is impacting Canadian popular culture, and many Canadians have been quick to embrace the new possibilities. For instance, in November of 2006, Toronto indie band Uncle Seth performed at Say What in Toronto and simulcasted their performance in Second Life, suggesting perhaps that one of the band's members had read a Wired article published 2 months earlier. In fact, months before Uncle Seth, pianist Lang Lang had given a live performance in Second Life, as had three orchestras, one of which was the Liverpool Philharmonic. In June 2007, The Guardian and Intel announced an ambitious, jointly hosted three-day musical festival in Second Life, featuring such headliners as the Pet Shop Boys, Hadouken, and Yu Young Pony Club. The festival attracted over 15,000 spectators and, despite some technical difficulties, was deemed a great success. And in Canada, as elsewhere, music and fashion are closely linked, so it's no surprise that in February of 2007, someone should create a fashion portal in Second Life. This was by a user named Kate Togoback, a social media and digital marketer, and she built a site called After a Fashion and wanted to develop something called a girls' night out in Second Life. Her intent was to form a small group of Canadian women to explore Second Life, and shopping was the main reason for it, but it was something that was open for negotiation when people joined. This announcement of the establishment of this shopping group was followed closely by a gallery of screen grabs of Kate's own work, illustrating what Kate's Second Life avatar, whose name is Katica Sparrow, would have worn had she attended the Oscars. Sort of interesting that the extent that people go to in terms of the attire that they wear and the time and expense they go into building not only skins for their avatar bodies, but also clothing to clothe their avatars. These two ads were also immediately preceded by the announcement of an online fashion show. This is actually a screenshot of a fashion show where they had a runway and models walking up and down the runway. This is a shot of some of the members of the audience. And let's not overlook the presence of a donation-sponsored, quite essentially Canadian cultural icon in Second Life, Tim Hortons. It's actually run mostly on donations from residents. No one pays for this or runs the site. And it's called the Unofficial Canadian Embassy. But it isn't just Canadian music and fashion that is being impacted by the virtual worlds phenomenon. It's also coming into the business world, too. On September 25, 2007, Davis LLP became the first Canadian law firm to open an office in Second Life, launched by a group within the firm that focused on intellectual property, technology, and video game law. The initiative seems not entirely unfitting. The group's press release states, the Davis lawyers present in Second Life are represented by avatars, digital representations of people, and the virtual office features a lobby, a library with topical legal information, a recruiting center, and a secure boardroom. There are, of course, other businesses. This is just examples of a couple of others. Canada Post actually has an outlet in Second Life. And also, the other one on the screen there is a Global Condo Center, which is out based in Vancouver And they used Second Life to showcase properties that they're trying to sell and rent so people could go in and have virtual tours of the properties. So they use it as a selling device. A number of large corporations are also attracted to Second Life, not because of its marketing or its sales promise, but its ability to facilitate in-house communication and collaboration. Compared to hosting large conferences and paying for accommodation and travel expenses, buying and maintaining a Second Life island is relatively inexpensive. In April 2008, for instance, Sun Microsystems, after its acquisition of MySQL, hosted a 12-hour corporate meeting on one of its 7 Second Life islands. Only 2 of those islands, which are open to the public, the rest are all used for internal communication, bringing hundreds of old and new employees together. And high-tech titan IBM, which has nearly 387,000 employees in 170 countries, has about 5,000 workers visit Second Life and other virtual worlds to conduct meetings, to train new employees and hold orientation settings. And the little shots up there were of the some of the islands and facilities that Sun Microsystems and IBM have built within Second Life. In April 2008, IBM became the first company to actually host versions of Second Life on its own corporate servers because of security reasons. And Linden Labs worked closely with IBM, and it's expected that this development is going to lead to more corporations using Second Life when the security and access can be improved. In addition to Sun and IBM, over 100 large corporations of the like of Ben & Jerry, Best Buy, Cisco Systems, Dell, H&R Block, Reuters, and Toyota, for instance, have a presence in Second Life. But what such corporations are also discovering is that Second Life can be invaluable for staging simulations that would otherwise be too costly to do in the real world. We have so Best Buy, Cisco, H&R Block, Reuters were the 4 of the top 8. Dell, Pontiac, who have since actually closed down their operation and moved out of Second Life, they were using it primarily for advertising and promotion, and actually it's pretty hard to justify the amount it costs if that's all they're using Second Life for. It seems that the return for businesses is much better if it's being used internally for training and communication. And the virtual world is also proving an invaluable corporate recruitment tool for executive search agencies. TMP Worldwide Advertising and Communications, for example, established a Second Life island early in 2007, and others, such as Career Builders and Accenture, one of the world's largest recruitment agencies, soon followed. But not only corporate recruiters are looking to Second Life to meet their staffing needs, as evidenced by the launch of 2 in-world law enforcement recruitment campaigns, Vancouver Police in June 2007 and Western Australian Police in September of 2008. A couple of shots there of the Vancouver Police didn't actually establish an island or a presence in Second Life. They held a seminar for a period of time. But the Western Australian Police actually set up a pavilion, and they have a space, a permanent structure within Second Life. The top shot is the Vancouver, from the Vancouver seminar. I think it was meant to attract male recruits, but I could be wrong. No surprise then that the communicative, collaborative simulation and recruitment potential of Second Life should attract the attention of Canada's colleges and universities, a number of whom were early to establish a presence in Second Life. Colleges Mohawk and Loyalist were among the first, but LaSalle soon followed, announcing its presence in December of 2006 with the opening of Edu Island. Later in February 2007, Mohawk firmly established its own presence in Second Life with its own island. But of the 3 colleges, LaSalle's foray into Second Life was the most ambitious, launched with the promise to relocate all of its distance education offerings to the virtual domain, technology permitting. That was a huge undertaking that they were actually going to start talking about developing and offering courses in Second Life, and I think that's just hasn't proven to be possible for most people who have attempted something of that magnitude. But the other colleges were using it, again, more for promotion and advertising and support rather than provision. But I think as the technology improves, you'll see more and more people offering and providing services within Second Life. But it was Canada's westernmost province, BC, that staged perhaps the most spectacular entrance so far witnessed into the world of Second Life, announcing the launch of a new Centre for Digital Media and a Master's Degree of Digital Media. On September 14th, the Centre for Digital Media and Master's Digital Media program was officially launched in BC, and Premier Gordon Campbell, the centre's executive director, Dr. Jerry Sinclair, and a number of school students participated in the unveiling in both the real world and the virtual world of Second Life. Just some shots here that sort of show the virtual opening alongside the real opening. Kind of running a little short on time, as I anticipated I would, so I want to make a quick sort of segue that one of the criticisms of people that spend time gaming online and in virtual worlds is that they're sort of very egocentric, self-interested, detached, and don't have the kind of social and political commitment that they should. I'm not sure that the facts have to support that. In fact, there's growing evidence that suggests that virtual worlds can be used to build community and to help people develop political and social awareness. And a couple of slides here I'll show you. The first was from July of 2006 in China, of all places. This is before the Chinese really opened up as much as they have today. But they had a huge protest there, an online protest involving 80,000 people that was against the developer because they had groups of players that were using the virtual world were accused of being anti-Japanese, and they threatened to shut down their guild. And speculation was that the Chinese company was actually trying to sell to a Japanese buyer. And there was a huge individual and what became a political protest because the Chinese and the Japanese have a history of wars going back thousands of years, and there was a lot of bad feeling, and it seemed that this particular event triggered a lot of animosity again. Also in January of 2007, the National Front, based in France, decided to set up a presence in Second Life. And as soon as they opened it, there was an immediate protest by people, initially sort of fairly peaceful, but that quickly devolved into an open war, which was conducted with sort of virtual weapons, and there was property destruction, and people were actually killed in sort of quotation marks. But again, I think it gives it should give us pause to think about how virtual worlds and those who inhabit them can actually be involved in political and social protest and are not detached from the real world, and in fact may even become more attached to what's happening in the real world because of contacts and beliefs they build in the virtual world. Another major event was an online strike that was actually held against IBM. It was significant because IBM has such a large presence in Second Life. But what happened was that a number of workers who had been threatened with their wage loss protested outside the IBM virtual building in Second Life. And it was joined by workers from around the world. And this is one of the things that people have realized is that these virtual communities do give people that don't have physical proximity the ability to join together and be involved in collective action. So this was a first. There have been others since then, and the labor movement is now using Second Life for a number of other things. They've had information days and World Workers Days, and this, I think, a number of organizations are looking at how this could be used in the future. Now, another sort of abrupt segue here, but I want to get into the sort of pedagogical possibilities of virtual worlds, because one of the things that excited me when I first looked at it was that although virtual worlds were constructed and developed for a particular purpose, they can be used for other things. You know, once you get access to that server, to that simulator, and you're in that environment, you can do other things other than engage in the kind of competition and play that the developers designed for you. And one really interesting development that I was interested in was within the virtual world of Halo, which is a military environment, sort of post-apocalyptic first-person shooter. And this was on a website of a person that actually develops a talk show within the Halo environment and invites people in to talk about interesting developments in popular culture and in culture itself. And I think some of the points that he raises were really...
Welcome to The Start in Life. I'm your host, Damian Lacedamian. And over here on my right is Dr. Octavit, spinning the finest in chiptune music. As this is our first show, I'd like to take a few minutes just to explain what is going on here. This is a talk show, like any other, where we invite interesting guests on to tell us about their work or participate in some of our first skits. But the difference is the environment we are in here. This show is taped live from an online video game. The host, guest, and even the crew are all players. Instead of playing the usual game, though, and shooting at each other, we're using the game to make the show. The game we're in is a violent game, but it's also rich enough that we can make room for other kinds of activity, provided that we establish a secure area.
So it's really interesting, I think, the way that there's a number of episodes that are available online and you can look at, and he invites some really interesting guests in. One of them is Peggy Awash, who does independent video work, and she studied some video games. And he has conversations with her, but one guest he had was particularly interested in was Mackenzie Walk, who's a teaches cultural theory at New York University. And they were talking about Mackenzie Walk has this theory about how the world is developing generally in terms of three large developments, that initially you had this sort of topical view of the world, where people lived in the real world and didn't really think too much about it. And then in the early modern period, as technologies improved and communication technologies improved, a different kind of space emerged, and that was what he calls a topographical space. And what he was saying was that initially there were these sort of islands of activity with large spaces of non-communication between them. And as you move into a topographical world, those spaces become smaller and the connections become greater. And his view is that we're moving towards actually a topological world that we're moving towards, and that will be as technology and communication improves, the spaces between will become much, much smaller, and it will be easier to make transitions from one area to another, much like within a virtual world where you can transport from one area to another with great ease. And his point is that as the real world moves towards this topological way of being, what better way to prepare for it than to spend time in virtual worlds, submersing yourself in that reality and learning more about what's possible and what can be done. And the other issue let me play this clip first.
I really like the way you talk about the difference between the topical world, the topographic world, and the coming topological world. And I was reminded of the way our world here in this game is the product of data that's constantly being sent in packets from console to console, and how little flaws in that process can expose the entire apparatus. So what should we know about the topological world? The way of kind of imagining that spaces get woven together ever more tightly by more and more lines of transport and communication. And so I use these three terms, the topical, the idea of an ancient world, where everything is like little spaces that are very, very imperfectly and tenuously connected together. And then the topographic is, if you like, the early modern world, where railway and telegraph start to sort of thread it together, but really it's really not quite there. But to give us a sense of a first stage of where we're heading, which is what I call topology or topological, a sense in which every place and everything is connectable to everything else. So you could transform any part of the world into any other part of the world, if you like.
Transfer and communication.
Yeah. I'm interested in the way that certain kind of games model what that might be like to live in this topological world where you can leap from one space to the other, as for example you can in this game, pick up objects, transform objects. How do we start to then think through our culture about what it means to be in that kind of topological space? When our very presence is abstracted, as it is in online gaming, it does seem like we're being prepared for a new kind of world. I mean, in some sense, we just moved from one place to another. Yeah, I like the way the teleporter is sort of like an image of what topological space is kind of like. I mean, for example, I could design something on my laptop and just send the specs off to a factory and they'll mail it back to me. There's a sense in which these things don't have to be together in space. We can bend one point in space to connect another. And the thing about a game like this is it gives you a sense of what it's like to live in a space like that.
President Eisenhower
Okay, so from that, what I wanted to sort of move to is that there are some other theorists that are looking at virtual worlds and virtual spaces in terms of how they can be used and what potential they have for purposes other than which they were intended. Now, Mackenzie Walk's point is that as we move more and more towards this topological world, and technologies improve and communications improve, it becomes possible to have more instantaneous kinds of presence, representation, and communication. But at the same time, that becomes sort of totalizing, that everything you do is monitored and can be followed and can be watched. So does that mean that we're going to get to a certain point in development where everything that we do will be run sort of algorithmically by rules that govern what is possible for us to do? Mackenzie Walk's point is that the real world is trying to adopt that sort of algorithmic way of operating together so it can get more and more control to be more effective and efficient. But the reality is that because it's the real world and not a constructed environment, the algorithms will always be imperfect. There'll always be problems with them. Whereas in a virtual world, which is created algorithmically by programmers, when you're in that kind of environment, you have a much better sense of what it is we're heading towards. And the other point is that even in a created world that's governed by much more stringent algorithms, there are still problems. There are glitches in the code, and there are spaces within the existing virtual reality that people can exploit. And if any of you saw, the Matrix series, it says that idea of, the code is never perfect. And although there's a sense in a way that we lose control in these kinds of totalitarian environments, there's still opportunities where you can find spaces to do things other than what are planned for you. And I think that this is what this show, like This Spartan Life, there's another one called Red and Blue, which is shot in another simulated environment. And there's a whole series now, a whole art form called machinima, where people actually make movies in virtual worlds, using virtual world engines to make movies for other purposes. And so this is what I was sort of looking toward and thinking about, and one of the proposals that as educators, we should be looking at these environments and not writing them off because they're, you know, first-person shooter games or role-playing games where crazy people go around chasing monsters. It's actually, in a way, it's a little akin to what happened with the civil rights movement in the States. That, you know, many of the blacks in the southern states didn't have the awareness and the motivation and the wherewithal, often the consciousness, if you want to call it, to advance their own interests. So many from the, you know, sort of intellectuals from the north, activists from the north, went down into the south and helped to motivate and to galvanize that population. And I think there's a sort of a parallel here between what's going on in these virtual worlds. Well, I think to some extent there are a lot of young people who are involved in those environments that are not necessarily as engaged as they could be, but there are great opportunities to go there and engage them in ways that would re-galvanize them and lead to them being more engaged in the real world. And I think this is the challenge for educators, is to look at these new environments and think, you know, how could we use them? What are the possibilities like? And people have, in this spot in life, he talks a little bit about what he calls glitching, and that's the environment of Halo is built with the expectation that people will only go so far in it. So the programming code only goes so far. But if as a player, you can go right to the boundaries of that programming code, and there's environments that you can enter that are not as well developed as they could be, but there are areas that you can go into and use them for purposes that they weren't necessarily intended for. So it's, I think it's just a really interesting phenomenon, and I think it's something that bears exploring, and that was the whole purpose of this, was to hopefully excite people a little bit about the possibilities of these virtual worlds, and to not have them look at them as negatively as they initially might, and to start thinking about some of their positive possibilities. Thank you. More educators who are very concerned about the addictive potential possibilities of virtual worlds, because people can spend enormous amounts of time involved in them. And there are those who are adamantly against them, and there are those that see virtual worlds as being representative of a new kind of, you know, cohort that's emerging, this idea of the, you know, the digital natives, children that are growing up, you know, doing three things at one time online while they're doing their homework, listening to videos and, you know, watching a movie and the TV's going in the background. There are claims that the fact that children are now doing that, that physical changes are actually occurring to their brains. That's kind of contentious, and it hasn't been demonstrated one way or the other, but what clearly is happening is that people are thinking differently. Even if the physical state of their brain isn't changing, many of these children, you know, do think and learn much differently. And it's a real challenge to think about how you can keep these children more occupied and give them learning that's relevant and challenging and engaging. And the reality is that many of them are much more receptive to spending time online in virtual worlds than they are in classrooms. So I think the challenge is to educators. You know, we can turn our back on that and say they shouldn't be doing it, but the reality is they are, and it just, that's it, and we have to find ways of dealing with it.
Okay, well, the other book that I've read recently is Growing Up Digital. It's new, it's out on the shelves with chapters and stuff, but I wasn't totally impressed by the level of research. There were a few things I didn't totally agree with, but the author of that book strongly supports what you were saying here in some of the research that, you know, the stereotypes are wrong, and especially when it comes to, you know, labeling the young people today as, you know, self-indulgent and self-centered and not very smart. And this guy presents very strong arguments suggesting that it's really quite the contrary. So.
With most of these servers hosted in probably Southern California, and the move to put our education online, do you see any problems with the Patriot Act and the U.S. Government trying to control knowledge and technology?
Yeah, that's a good question, Mike. I think that's always an issue, and I think that's, you know, in a way, what we're seeing now with companies like, you know, corporations like IBM insisting that they'll only continue to work and use Second Life if they can host it on their own servers is something we'll be seeing more of in the future, where people won't be satisfied to have that sort of information and sort of virtual intellectual property hosted in other parts of the world that could be impacted for political or economic or all kinds of different reasons. I think people are, you know, it's a tremendous investment, I mean, in just in terms of person hours to develop facilities in Second Life. I mean, there's a real cost to it. Even though it's not a real building, you put a lot of labor into crafting and working with it. So people, this is another issue that I didn't really get into, which the paper speaks about too, is the whole issue of end-user license agreements, you know, and how much control a developer should have as compared to the users. And who should be making decisions about directions and developments within these virtual environments? Is it solely the right of the developer, or is it now the place of the community? Should the developers be stepping back, and should the communities be taking over political and cultural control, much as in the real world where we have democratic governments? And there is a movement toward that too. A group of people are actually constructing a democratic end-user license agreement process where developers and users can engage together. But that's a good question, and I think it's something that will have to be resolved, because as you say, right now, you know, who wants information on American servers when that information can be used against you to put you on the no-fly list or whatever. Next time you go to the States, you're held at the airport because of something you said in a user forum in Second Life. You know?
I guess I have two random thoughts. The first was related back to the stereotype and dispelling stereotype issues. I think that's important. That's a really interesting point and interesting study that you brought up. I suspect, I think that there would be a lot of, and maybe there is, it's not my area, but a lot of further research in that area, because to me, I mean, stereotypes could also be a lag effect, right? In the sense that, you know, if you look at the actual people that the study identified, the 35 plus or average age and that kind of stuff, then you look back to when you had your timeline as to how things were developing, the IT was developing, and so you look back 20 years ago and they're 15, you know, and they were right when IT was developing. So to do further exploration on the devil's demographic and socioeconomic data and facts and trends, right, and to try and more readily clarify their situations 20 years ago, for example, and then extrapolate from that as to what that may mean for the people that, you know, now, the 15-year-olds and so on that are growing up and where that might take them 20 years from now. I think that there's some whole interesting probably body area of work there and difficult to get at. And then the second disparate thought is, and it's more a question. I don't have an avatar on Second Life, and so other people may understand better than me. But I don't really understand the sort of the non-competitive online game environment. I understand the other couple games you brought up. Uses examples where you're a first-person shooter and you're out and you're, you know, maybe it's escapist or whatever, and it's entertainment, and you're on there and you're trying to do something, and then you leave and you go back to your real life and then so on. But the non-competitive aspect, I don't understand what attracts people to the Second Life, what they're doing there, why they're there, and how then it links back to real life. Like, that was a very interesting point you brought up about the marketing. And to me, I just assume all, you know, and you mentioned the entertainment, the simulcast, things like that, and I read a little bit about that. I've never seen one, but I mean, that I can understand. I can understand the attraction of a simulcast, the entertainment, someone goes there as an avatar and watches a concert or whatever. But if you take away that marketing aspect, that marketing and development aspect for real corporation in the real life as the motivation, and you focus on the other aspects of whatever that, I don't understand that portion of it.
Yeah, no, they're good points, Derek. The statistical one is a very valid point. Part of the problem is because a lot of the people that own these virtual worlds are reluctant to give out real stats, because they're playing marketing games, you know, in terms of subscriptions and numbers, and they want to look really good, and they're protective, they're private businesses, so it isn't easy to get access to those kinds of stats, and they don't report them very well either, and when they do report them, they report them differently. Everybody reports them differently. So there's a couple of websites that track them, and it's when you start trying to make comparisons, you see how difficult it is, you know, in terms of how players are identified in terms of subscriptions and free players and so on. But the one study I cited was actually, it's done through Sony Corporation, who handed over all of their data from EverQuest to several academics, and they're crunching through a whole bunch of stats based on that. But as you say, it's sort of, at this point, it's a one-shot deal. It's going to be a snapshot. And I think there are going to be, you know, incremental developments and developments over time, you know, trends that need to be tracked, and that, and there are people that are more interested in that than I am, you know, but I think it's work that needs to be done, and hopefully the developers will be more forthcoming and we'll get a better view of, you know, what people are doing. As to Second Life, I think, you know, people are in there for lots of different reasons. I mean, it's a, as with many things on the internet, you know, it's driven by sex. A lot of the technology on the internet was pushed the envelope because of, you know, sex sites that were delivering bigger graphic files, video files, sign-up accounts where you had to have access to web pages. These were all the first sites that really pushed commerce on the internet, and then legitimate business came in afterwards. And Second Life's a little bit like that. They had a big sort of brouhaha a couple of years ago about what they were calling age play, which was avatars of adults playing with avatars of children. Now, there was no way of knowing, you know, who the real people behind the avatars were, but this kind of age play was frowned upon, and eventually it was shut down within Second Life. So there's always those illicit activities that people will go into these spaces to engage in. But there's a lot of other, I mean, there are people that are making a living there. I mean, there are, you know, I didn't mention it again in the paper, I mentioned it, the real estate lady, get her name right now, who made over $1 million, like real dollars, by selling virtual real estate in Second Life. There are other people who manufacture all kinds of things, like skin. They do toning on your skin and coloring, and people want to improve their avatars, and so they sell those services. There's people that make clothing, jewelry, vehicles. They'll build houses for you. They're selling those services, and those services, although they're sold in terms of Linden dollars, virtual dollars, those dollars are exchanged on real markets. I think right now it's about 240 Linden dollars to one American dollar US, like a US dollar. And so real money changes hands. And it's a real issue for tax people right now, because people are actually earning their living in Second Life. And so how do they declare that as income? Normally they wouldn't, because there's really no real productivity coming from it. But now, so they're going to have to sort of revise the taxation laws because of that. That's one element. The other thing about Second Life is it's great for creative people who can sort of go in and do things that they would not otherwise be able to do or afford to do, like building huge structures, sculpting, design, possibilities that wouldn't be open to them in the real world. So there's those possibilities. And of course, there's always the group that's always mentioned, the people who are disabled, you know, who can't get around, who are immobile, paraplegics, quadriplegics, people with, you know, facial deformities, speech deformities. They can take on one of these avatars in Second Life and communicate and be part of communities in the same way as everybody else there. So it sort of levels the playing field for them, and there's a lot of positive comments that have been made about that. And the other exciting thing, I think, is that people that are, you can actually, in Second Life, you can do things that are just not possible in the real world. Like there's one island where they build graphical representations of mathematical formulas. They've got these huge sort of prisms and with lines and matrices of, that are joined, and you can walk inside of them and sort of see how the formula looks from inside, which just wouldn't be possible in the real world. So I think people are attracted to it for that, you know, for those reasons. You know, so, and the socializing thing, some people are more comfortable socializing virtually. They feel they can have a relationship with someone online where they can get what they need in terms of communication and contact without committing to sort of physical intimacy or physical proximity. So there's a whole range of reasons why people, I think, you know, inhabit Second Life. And there's really no one answer, and there's a lot of stuff going on. And probably there will continue to be other reasons when, you know, why people take it up and move in there.
Thanks. I guess just to follow up, and I mean, I apologize. I just can't wrap my head around it all. But I mean, so with Second Life again, so you have there's linkages, like you've explained, between the outside world, the real world, and the virtual world. And you mentioned a number of corporations that are in there, and you mentioned the colleges that are in there for, you know, and then promotion, recruitment, that kind of stuff. So I guess thinking in terms of our university here, other than marketing and promotion and recruitment to the real world, and if that isn't maybe necessarily taken within the virtual world so well, I mean, if the people in the virtual world who are most active are out there trying to improve their avatars and do what these things you mentioned, what they're trying to do, they may not really be interested in the outside world and the marketing and bringing it in. So what other activities would corporations and education institutions like ours do in the virtual world? Like, to me, you know, it opens up the possibility, like, do you offer a virtual degree? You offer people for your avatar to go in, and your avatar goes to virtual lessons of some type, and can you earn a virtual degree, and then what would that afford you in the virtual world? You know, so I mean, I know these are big ifs, and there's probably much more beyond on that, but that's sort of the difficulty I have. And then if you were doing that, what would it look like? A virtual degree. Would you be giving real instruction on how to program within Second Life, or would it just be some kind of sort of more meaningless thing that you don't put a cap on your head and I'm a graduate type thing? You know, it opens up a whole bunch of questions, and I think it's a fascinating a topic and area, and you know, not that I would be able to, I'm sure, wrap my head around it anytime soon, but I think it's really fascinating.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it does raise a lot of questions. Right now, with the way the technology is, I'm not sure there's any real advantage to going to the time and effort and expense of establishing, you know, a virtual classroom and having students, you know, build their own avatars and then coming to sit in the classroom and having an avatar of a professor lecture to them. I'm not sure what that would add to anything, you know, but so I don't think it's that straight kind of equivalence. I don't think you can make connections across the board like that. I think a lot of people are still thinking about how they can use Second Life, and I think a lot of the uses that will emerge in the future will probably be of things that we hadn't thought of before and are not able to do. I think the one thing sort of communicatively is that it can really breach people who are geographically diverse and can bring people together. And I think these corporations like Sun Microsystems and IBM are discovering that as the technology improves, you can bring large collections of people together, you know, 200-300 people, and have, you know, one-day seminars or two-day conferences that can be very productive from a sort of corporate perspective. And also, you know, and it really lowers the expense for them. So there's a real return.
I understand that concept of using it, and I'm just trying to separate that out. Like, I thought it was a great example you gave about the seminar, you know, holding a corporation holding a seminar in the virtual world. I'm trying to distinguish, I guess, the difference between using, you know, a corporation or an entity or an institution using Second Life to further their real world institutional operations. So not using so much as participating, right? So if that we were going to make that distinction, how as an institution would you participate as opposed, you know, and just to further the experience of the other avatars?
Well, I think we deal with that a little bit right now at AU with distance education, you know. I mean, there are a lot of people at AU that just teach disciplines, you know, and they teach disciplinary knowledge at a distance. And to gain access to that knowledge, you have to become proficient in certain skill sets, whether it's, you know, typing your papers or emailing or even using the telephone. To access that knowledge, you have to sort of, you know, learn something new. And Second Life's a little bit like that too. I think the overhead right now is just too high. Like, you know, if I was to teach, say, a course in sociology in Second Life, I would never get to the disciplinary content because I'd spend the whole term helping people to navigate around and, you know, how to move their avatars and how to open doors and all that stuff. There's a huge overhead that has nothing to do with the educational process. Now, you could be offering, as you do, as we do, we offer distance education courses in distance education. And I think there are lots of colleges that offer more sort of educational courses that are in technologies. So I think there could be educational opportunities in Second Life where it's sort of like, you know, we're going to give you a certificate because we'll take you to the process of constructing a building and you'll learn all the skills that are necessary, or starting a virtual business. I think that is there. But in terms of like higher education with the kind of disciplinary knowledge that we're using, it's not clear to me yet what the advantage of doing that in a virtual world is. But I think we have to be very cognizant of developments in virtual worlds and think about what new possibilities are emerging. You know, and it might not be a matter, I think LaSalle College is an example of, you know, looking at it and saying, oh, wow, we're going to shift all our offerings into Second Life. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just not possible right now with the technology. It may not be for years. But that said, I think there's lots of things we can do, just as we use conference boards and a content management system. There's things we can use in Second Life. And I think we should be looking as to what we can get out of that as educators, you know, what the possibilities are.
Yeah, some of the simulation possibilities are pretty amazing. I hadn't thought of mathematical formulas as ever being something you could look at. And now I'm thinking, you know, I'm reading a stats book right now, and there's something last night that I actually had to visualize, and it would have been very helpful to see some kind of a model. But certainly in specific disciplines like architecture or, you know, different kinds of design programs, there are a lot of potential. There's an island where you can actually walk through a tsunami. And so there's definitely interesting things that you can do there. In terms of demographics as well, I was kind of blown away when you suggested that, you know, according to this one study, a lot of the people involved were very fit, physically fit, which right away made me think, well, you know, are these, okay, game players? Are they maybe like
people who play games in the real world too, stay fit, you know, maybe they're out playing racquetball. It'd be kind of interesting to correlate some statistics, if it were ever possible, with things like the Myers-Briggs or some of the other, you know, psychological tests that you can do, and just kind of see what's out there. And what you might find is that you got the whole rainbow of people involved.
I think you do. This is the kind of work that needs to be done. I think this is really interesting stuff. There was a documentary completed last year, which was really interesting, called Second Skin. And they asked advertised and asked people who were fairly skilled in role-playing games like World of Warcraft, like at the 70th level, so like guild masters. These are people who have, you know, 200 people underneath them or something. And then wanted to draw correlations between how the kind of skills they learned as guild masters in role-playing cashed out in terms of the jobs they had in the real world. Like, were these people like super managers? Were they super organized? Were they good leaders? All the stuff we haven't really looked at. You know, like, so you're playing a game, just enjoying the game, enjoying the rules, but what are you learning without really, you know, problem solving, conflict resolution? There's all kinds of things that people, and you know, like strategizing, there's lots of skills that people are learning that are not really being focused on because they're sort of byproducts of this quest, this magical quest they're engaged in. But they could be reaping significant real benefits from that. So I think this is the kind of work that we need to do, the kind of research to look at is, well, how are people benefiting? Are these really wasted hours when people spend time in these virtual worlds? Is it like a waste of your life, which is often the sort of popular response you get, is that it's a complete waste of time.
Yeah, or you're running away from something. The other thing is socioeconomic status, because, you know, it takes a certain amount of leisure time. You have to have some computer equipment. You have to have bandwidth. So, you know, what's the impact there? And
well, that comes back to my earlier, or one of the reasons from earlier question on the statistics was that, I mean, you might very well, just obviously just guessing, but if the group that study had focused on 35, you averaged age 35, 25,000 above the average income, which is probably almost double, maybe not quite, but that's a significantly higher average income. They very likely could have come from quite well-to-do families early on, right? But now the access to those, that kind of technology, is almost ubiquitous. So what does that mean for the trajectory in the next 20 or 30 years?
Well, it's kind of ubiquitous, like here in Canada, but you still have, you know, limitations up north and in various communities, and worldwide you'd have to take a look as well.
Yeah, but relatively speaking to 1982, right, the percentage of households that would have had access to the type of those type of technologies and ability to develop those skills and interest, it's much higher now.
There were those initial barriers, and those barriers continue to be there, but there is a real drive to improve networking. Like a lot of corporations, like the big thing right now is, you know, real-time broadcasting of TV and movies, you know, like real-time from the net onto your computer. Netflix is offering movies for download now. They're pushing the developers and the network people to improve networking, and you're seeing more and more fiber right to the curb, you know, so the bandwidth is increasing phenomenally. Now, there's always going to be areas of the world that don't have that kind of access, but I think that some of the earlier technological barriers and networking barriers that you had in the beginning are going to be gone pretty soon, and it's really going to open up the kinds of things that are possible. Like in Second Life, if you had 200 people, you know, engaged in a meeting on one simulator, it would grind to a very, you know, the activities were very slow just because of that number of people doing different things in a small area of the server. Now that's changing, and you can have much larger meetings and more people, and the actual performance is not impacted. that means that the technology itself is going to be freed to do things that it couldn't in the past because of technological barriers. It'll be really interesting to see where it goes as that happens. You know. Interesting stuff anyway, lots to think about.